We should start with how we met.
Okay.
So yes. This is the beginning of the story of how we met. This is Faith and my son Micah. And you'll see Micah is quite an avid reader. And he's reading Rick's book, Entrepreneurial Leadership. So just randomly, Micah picked up the book, and it actually looks like he's reading it. So I was like, okay, I need to do something with this photo. So I sent it to Paul Stevens, who was one of the co-authors, and I think Rick wrote back saying, at least someone's reading our book.
Yeah. I think he's the most excited person to read the book. So I think that could be the cover shot for the book. And that book is available at the back, Entrepreneurial Leadership. So there's a great endorsement. So that's the way we first connected. And, you know, when I first met John and started talking about his early days just tinkering around with the web and software solutions, so just describe how you got started in this whole area.
Sure, yeah. I grew up in a really interesting family. I'm the oldest of six children. My father's in kind of accounting finance field, and so my parents were so different. My father, we'd be walking down the street, and he'd be analyzing the profitability of plaza shops. So he'd be like, "Oh, John, this shop's gonna go under for sure," and so very analytical. And my mother was a homemaker and the most creative person I've ever met. So I'd come home from school, and she would have invented a new cleaning device that would like minimize work effort, because she had techniques. She had a lot of techniques to get all the children to do the cleaning as well. I'd come home another day, and she's like, "Okay, we're going to open a coffee shop." So she was definitely a quick start at coming up with all these ideas. And so actually all my siblings kind of benefited from this kind of analytical side of my father and this insanely creative side of my mother. So maybe a story that's emblematic of that was, let me take you back to, grade 11. And I brought a photo for you. That's me. Can you kind of see it? So this was me in grade 11. I did eat. I'm not sure. Not sure what happened, but yeah. So I love programming. My dad told me I wasn't allowed to program until I was in grade 9. I was begging in grade 6, and he said, "Okay, in grade 9, I'll get you a computer and you can learn to program." So I just kind of started down this path. I decided instead of wasting my time all summer, I would read this big tome on C++, which is kind of this old programming language. Some technical people, I see someone laughing over here. So, so I started reading through that. It's very dry stuff, by the way. But I was like, okay, well, maybe I'll set up a website. So I set up this website, C++ Programmer's Den, and had these different tutorials on programming. And on the left, I had this box that was this book, and it linked over to Amazon. And Amazon had just released their affiliate program. So it's morphed over time, but at that time, if you linked to Amazon's website with your kind of code in the website address, you could get like 10% of the purchase price of the book. So I made $20. It was, and then 40, and it occurred to me, I was like, this is interesting. I did this for one book. What if I did it for 100 books? So I wrote some software that would. It's called a spider, but it would like basically go to Amazon's website, click every link, and just keep clicking all the links until it landed on a book page. And if it did, it would put it in a database. And so I ran this engine, and it picked up 500,000, 10,000, 50,000, 100,000, 400,000 book profiles. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. I got a lot of data in this database. And my high school had just got a high-speed internet connection, which at the time was like 100 megabit, which was a big deal back then. Actually, most people have 100, maybe 100 megabit with Bell 5 or something now. And so I convinced my computer teacher, Chris, to let me take this home computer and stick it under his desk, because I was in charge of the school website. So I plugged it in, and the other website I was doing was, okay, I was going to figure out how to make all these web pages. So anyways, so I wrote this program that would make 400,000 web pages from all that data and then submit it to all these search engines. At the time, there were like 10 different popular search engines. And but then before I turned it on, I was like, okay, wait, there's some books I don't want to sell, right? So I came up with, I could only think of maybe sexual things that I was like, I don't want to sell a book about sex or something like that. So I came up with the 40 words I knew that I might want to exclude and turned it on. And so there went, so yeah, so the first month was like $3,000 came in through that thing. Next month, $4,000. And I was like, wow, this is pretty good for doing no work. And but then all of a sudden, Chris, the computer science teacher, called me into his office and he said, John, what have you done? And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, well, the principal just got a phone call from an author of a book, and he doesn't really think it's appropriate that, you know, that book is being used in our school. Like, are there books somehow related to the school website? And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, let me tell you what I've been doing. And and he said the author of this book was, he had written a book on Hitler's philosophy. And so I was selling a book on Hitler's philosophy. And so Chris was like, okay, let's talk more about this tomorrow. So I went home, and remember I opened up that folder on my hard drive, 400,000 files, and I clicked on one. I was like, oh, I don't want to be selling a book like that. I clicked on another one. Oh, and I just realized, I was like, okay, I don't have a way to filter this. Now I'm like, hey, you just filter. I know how to filter it now, ISBN, tag to category, whatever. But at the time, I had no clue how to filter it. And so I prayed with my dad about it. And we both agreed, okay, I made the decision. I was like, okay, I'm going to turn this off because I have no way to filter it. And so the next day, Chris was like, okay, so let's talk about the money you made from this thing. And I was, so we agreed I'd keep 50% of the money I made, and with the other 50%, we'd build a high school computer science library. So we spent a couple $1,000s on all these computer science books. But then, anyway, so that was one of your
early experiences.
But I think one of the things I took away from that was like those ethical choices, they don't leave, and they just get bigger and bigger. That was maybe, let's say that was a $20,000 decision. The next one for me was like $200,000, $20 million decision later, where you really have to choose to honor the Lord in what you're doing and put Him first.
So fast forward a bit to your next entrepreneurial venture that eventually led to School Messenger and how that got started and how that developed.
Yeah, so we, so from there, I was, I started building some different software that would kind of handle, at that time, kind of document management websites, web content management, and I was now kind of beginning in my first year at university, and I put up this website trying to sell this product. Yeah, and I got this call, this fellow Robert Duca, who's from La Trobe, Pennsylvania. There's a company, Kennametal. I don't know if anyone's ever heard of them. And they're a Fortune 200 company. And he said, hey, we downloaded this software. We really like it. I'd like to fly up and meet you and your management team and your developers and see if we can do some work together.
I think you know.
Dorm room,
you
by
can
the
almost
way.
Think of like the Wizard of Oz, you know, like the witch who's behind the big facade. So,
yeah. So that started an interesting ball rolling, and eventually they were happy with the product, and they did decide to go ahead. So I mean that's pretty much me at the time, and there's kind of like this six-figure software delivery contract for 15,000 employees, and I realized, okay, if I don't put school on hold, I'm not going to be able to fulfill this contract.
And so what was like the core product? So maybe just explain, like, what were you actually providing?
So pretty much kind of it was an intranet product an internal portal product. So companies would set it up for, you know, their employees. The default homepage would be this intranet. And if you remember those drag and drop components, and you can kind of customize it, what's on the screen. And we'd pull in, you know, different data sources from around the company to personalize that for each employee.
Mm-hmm. And then talk about the like school messenger and what you did for the for schools. Like, what was the core product?
Yeah. So after that, I got going and I said, okay. So I put my university on hold, and then I was very interested in the pastor's daughter. And it was reciprocal, although not clearly articulated, that we were interested in each other.
That's very technical. It was not reciprocated, but was not clearly articulated. Some of you might want to use that line in the future.
So I went and it was this weird conversation where I was talking to her father, and I was like, okay, so I'm going to be putting my university on hold, but, you know, I am interested in your daughter. And my father was much more encouraging about, you know, going for it. So anyway, so we we built a bunch of different products in this kind of original company, Intrafinity, and we built maybe 20 different products over the course of 7 or 8 years. It was a small team. And then eventually I started to realize, I was like, okay, well, just programming products doesn't really cut it. You actually have to like build a scalable business. And so we started to take some of these products and spin them out. And so one of those was Sharp School. And that was providing, so imagine kind of websites, mobile apps for parents to see what's going on with kids in school. So it could be attendance, grades, announcements, that kind of thing. And yeah, we started out, we basically sold straight into the U.S.
And then which years was that?
Yeah, so it's probably 2008 to 2015. So it was about 7 years on
that. What was the uniqueness? Were you one of the first to do it, or what were you doing different or better?
I think we weren't one of the first. I think the product was quite robust because we had done projects with the U.S. Air Force Research Lab and Michigan State University and Intel implementing some of this technology, but then we ended up saying, okay, there is a niche here in education, and we're getting some traction, so we were able to provide a very robust kind of enterprise level product to these school districts. And so the larger ones appreciated that. I mean, like Los Angeles Unified School District, for example, it's like 1,400 schools. And TDSB wasn't a client, but they're one of the largest school districts in North America. Mm-hmm. So the average school district size in the U.S. is, guess, what do you think it is? 6 schools. Isn't that small? Yeah, so the average is 6 schools. I'd say the product was robust, and then we had a really good kind of sales marketing approach that helped us win.
And then just describe how you grew the business. So, you know, you start off with these ideas, you develop the software, develop the product. So while you're getting positive response from the market, how are you building the team, and what pace is that going at?
Yeah. Yeah, so we were in Sharp. So Sharp School, when we started, it was kind of maybe 2 employees, and over those 7 years, we got to about 100. So it was tough because we were growing at maybe 40-50% a year, which in some tech scales isn't much. I think, you know, some people are like 100% easy, 300% a year is hard. Well, this was 40-50% bootstrap. So there's like no external investment to help us drive that. So that it was very challenging, but we had this kind of team that we built up over time. Not a lot of people, that team didn't have a lot of original experience. I hired a lot of them out of school, and they just grew as amazing leaders in this organization. And so they were, like, after we sold the business, like, a lot of them got promoted into much higher roles, and like actually, like, I'm most proud of like this group that we worked with, and through the crucible of kind of growing this business so quickly.
So just describe who bought the company and then how that happened. Like, why did they buy it and what's happened since?
So it was kind of late 2015. We had two major players in this market. One was Blackboard and the other was called School Messenger. And that was owned by a public company, West. And they were kind of fighting it out. And so they came, actually both approached us at around the same time. And Blackboard's approach, the conversation was, it always starts with, like, hey, let's explore partnerships. And so you get on this call and the fellow's basically like, you know, I don't like competition. Why don't I just buy your business and get rid of another competitor? Like, this would be great. And it didn't sound very exciting, right? And I knew their playbook was buy the business, fire 80% of the staff, move customers over to the core, to their other competing product. And so I was just like, I was pretty attached to, like, these people. I don't want to just, like, have this business decimated. And then just right around the same time, West came along and they were like, hey, we don't have your product. It's a strategic acquisition. We're going to keep the entire team. And they did, except for, like, there was a couple people we agreed should go in the acquisition process. But, and that whole team is still there in Toronto. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was, I'd say that acquisition story is a really positive one.
Right.
You know, some aren't. And right. So I'm thankful that I was able to kind of take care of those folks.
So here we have an example of someone who's, you know, started a company literally from scratch. You've got experience, you know, in your teens, and like a lot of entrepreneurs, you put your heart and soul into this. And often, of course, what happens is your company becomes your identity. And we've talked about this.
Yeah.
So talk about the experience of putting your heart and soul into a company, basically giving everything to it, and then it comes to the point where now I'm selling it. So how did that impact you from a spiritual standpoint, and just generally in terms of how you viewed business?
Yeah. So there's actually kind of two stages to it. One was, for me personally, so one was a little earlier on, I'd say like 2 years before, 2 years before we sold. We had, you know, good, we had a good, I don't know, let's say 7,000-8,000 schools using the platform. Actually, I think I have a slide here, something like this, right? So, so every one of those dots, think of, like, you know, between, I don't know, 20 and 100 schools. And so they're using the platform. So pretty much like every, for the school to run, obviously teachers can teach, but if the teachers want to log in and, you know, put in a sick day or get access to any system, get access to Google, G Suite, they basically are going through our platform. And so what happened was we had a group of hackers. And that essentially started attacking the business. And so there's something called denial of service attacks. So just, it's a technical term, but essentially what that is imagine someone that's trying to just send an insane amount of traffic at your web application or your website to the point that the website will, the internet pipes that go to the website get full and then no one can access the website. So, I mean, maybe an analog version is if you had a million people dialing your phone number, you know, your friend that's trying to call can't get through. You know, so we and this had happened to us a couple times, but only for like 10 minutes. So when this big attack, this like flood of data would come, the system would go down for 10 minutes. Actually, some of the upstream like Bell, who would be an upstream provider for internet connectivity, would call us and say, okay, there's so much, this attack is so significant, we're taking you offline because it's taking down our whole network. And so it had happened for a few minutes, but it started happening where someone consistently was doing this. And it happened over a two-week period. So just imagine, like, you're in this office, 60 employees, 60, 70 employees, and all of a sudden, every single phone starts ringing with an angry customer. And your whole service is down, and it's down for, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, and it stops. And you're like, and then it starts again, and for like weeks, for like 2 weeks. And it was, what's tough about this kind of attack is for $10, you can actually do an attack like this for $10, it requires about $500,000 of infrastructure to defend against it. It's a little better now, but it's very asymmetric. And so we were just working 24/7 trying to isolate it, figure it. We'd finally block the attack, and then they'd go another route and where we'd kind of move things to and attack that, and it was just like constant. And so this was like a really crazy experience, but like it was about a week and a half in, I couldn't get out of bed. I was stuck in bed, and I was just completely devastated. And the emotional experience that the best parallel I have, I mean, I've never been beaten up in an alley, but it's like if I was going down, someone beat me up in an alley, obviously we'd have a lot of physical scars, but you'd have a lot of emotional scars as well. And so I felt like I'd been like entirely like beaten and bloodied emotionally. And my wife was like, John, I think you need to see a therapist. Like this isn't healthy. And so that was my start with Christian therapy. I'm a big fan of Christian therapy, by the way. I'm not going to ask people to put up their hand. Okay, who doesn't have a Christian therapist? You know, I'd say I really recommend it. So I walked into this, the kind of therapy appointment, sat down, and my therapist, Anne was there. And I've been seeing her every month for the last kind of six, seven years now. And we started, and I was just like, what is the point of this? Like, why am I doing this? Is it just to make money and donate it to my church? Because, like, I can't handle this. And we started this journey. And what I came to realize was my identity, this is getting to your point, your question. my identity was so deeply, like, tied in to the business that, like, the business and me were kind of, like, one from an identity perspective. I don't know if anyone gets this. This is kind of weird. Some people get this? Okay. So we're pretty much kind of like one identity. And so when this business was getting beaten up, I was being beaten up. And as Anne helped me kind of sit back and see this, I was like, yeah, something's not right here. This is, something's not healthy. So, maybe the principle is like, you become what you love. Maybe that's the principle. And so we started this journey where I was like, okay, how can I run a business, be an entrepreneurial leader running this business, but then how can I, and also separate my identity so it's separate in a healthy way, and also how can Christ be kind of number one? Because if you ask me theologically, or, you know, is God first in your life, I'd say yes. But my identity was fused with my business in like an ungodly way, in a sense. And so I worked. So that was the first step.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the challenges, and when I've spoken with John in the past, John's been very transparent about seeing a Christian therapist and wrestling with this idea of, you know, the identity wrapped up in a business. And I think that is a huge challenge for entrepreneurs, especially Christian entrepreneurs, because although we know theoretically, you know, we are not our business, if you looked at how people functioned, most people still function that way. And even simple questions like, we typically ask someone, well, what do you do? Not who are you?
Yeah.
We don't say, well, who are you? Well, that would be a weird question. Well, I'm a husband, I'm a parent, I'm lots of things, but we almost always ask, oh, so what do you do? So most of us are closely identified with our business, our very being, and with the success of that business, and the ups and downs of that business affect us and every other relationship. So that's something that John's wrestled with.
So that was the start of unraveling that. And then I think when we came to the sale, I couldn't have sold that business if I hadn't gone through that process. It would have been like selling organs. Like, you just can't sell organs, you know? And so I had to kind of separate that identity. And then I was then able to kind of go through the sale process. And I wasn't selling myself. I was selling this entity that was separate from me. And then I think the other side to it was and we probably don't have time to go through it today, and you talk a lot about it already, but my view of faith and work, I came from this kind of perspective where there's sacred and secular. Like, when I was at church, that was the sacred space, and when I was at work, I would try to live a godly life, but that wasn't really in the sphere of what God really cared deeply about. He cared about mostly, almost entirely spiritual things. So that was kind of like a theology I had grown up with. And so then the Lord had to do all this work to kind of break that down and realize actually He had called me to be in the marketplace and live out His kingdom in any sphere of influence that I have, and particularly in business. And so those two allowed me to kind of reorder
One other thing that we wanted to do is look at what are some technological trends. So if you saw online, the topic was my tech journey, but also looking at some technological trends. Some of you may not be that familiar with the high-tech space, but that's the world John lives in. So we've got a few PowerPoint slides.
Yeah,
if you
want to
go through them.
So I work with mental models, so I thought I'd bring a few for you. This isn't quite a mental model, but this is, a number of transistors in an integrated circuit. So you'll notice this is a logarithmic scale, and this kind of shows, processing capacity as it's grown over time, in particular CPUs. And so the key point here is that this technology trend with kind of transistors on a given chip operates in an exponential scale, right? It's on this power kind of, it's on an exponential scale. And this is one of the key things to understand about exponential technologies or technology as a tool in general. So the mental model is this. So one is our brain operates on a linear kind of scale. I think, okay, things get a little bit better every year. That's the black line. And the green line is the technology trend. And so so take the integrated circuit, number of transistors. Initially, if you go back a bunch of years and to those earlier times, all of us, I think, remember, how far we've come. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, I remember I had a 286. I mean, I could barely play Pac-Man on that thing, and that required a lot of work. And now we have these just insane devices that have millions of times more processing power in our pocket. So that's the first thing, that technology trends operate on this exponential scale, and then then a given trend ends. And so I think obviously there's we're just doing a very, very high level. There's a number of really interesting trends today. There's obviously like AI, machine learning. And what is maybe not entirely clear on this graph is like it's leveling off. So this exponential trend has come pretty much to an end, sometimes called the death of Moore's Law. But there are new trends. And so I'll give you an example. So like at Google's I/O, like big dev conference, I don't know how many of you saw it, they had this machine learning enabled bot that would call and make restaurant reservations. And they played it out on stage and you could kind of listen in. It would make a phone call. So the first phone call, this bot, and people reacted because it didn't say, oh, by the way, I'm a machine when it called. It just started acting like a human and it freaked a lot of people out and they're really angry. But it calls and basically says, I want to book an appointment. And that went kind of smoothly and the appointment was booked and everyone's like, wow. And then they played this tape where the person on the other end was completely incoherent And somehow it navigated through this very circuitous conversation to like still book the appointment. And everyone was just like in shock. It's like, wow, we can do this now? And that is, that shock is the top part of this green line. That chaos amazement where there's an exponential technology, an underlying exponential technology. In the past, it was kind of disappointing. And then now it's just like this, that emotion of like the shock is that experience of the nonlinear nature of most technologies. And so I think if I was to just describe why the machine learning, like the underlying machine learning technology is interesting, this is, these are stats from a large scale, visual recognition challenge. It was called ImageNet. And so pretty much for a decade before 2010, if someone moved that 28% by a fraction of a percent, it was this huge accomplishment. And essentially the challenge was you give an algorithm an image and it has to describe what it is. So you give an algorithm an image of a man holding a dog in a blue with a blue hat, right? And then the computer has to spit out, what does it see? You know, and then these old algorithms would say these random, confusing things. But that was the test. And could it say, oh, there's a man holding a dog with a blue hat? And so actually it's done by Jeffrey Hinton, who's out of University of Toronto and Google, and one of his students, where they started to apply this new deep learning, deep learning technology. And that has dropped this. This is the story of how those algorithms have improved over the last 7 years and the error rate. So now the solutions we have to do visual image description are very high quality. And so the question then is like, is this machine learning, kind of these AI, underlying AI deep learning technologies, an exponential technology? And so some people have mapped it this way. And this essentially is, once again, a logarithmic curve. AlexNet is like kind of Jeffrey Hinton and his students' solution to that ImageNet problem, right, where it started to make huge drops or huge increases in performance of these recognition algorithms. And you kind of see the amount of training power that has gone into the latest algorithm. So maybe some of you have heard of like AlphaGo, AlphaGo Zero, these algorithms that were able to kind of compete against the world's top Go player. And so these algorithms are just using an insane amount of training compute to train these machine learning models. So people are saying, okay, we see an exponential trend here, and I can't but agree that like this is a big trend that we've felt a little bit of, but in the next 10 years we're going to have a lot of those amazement moments as we go along the way. Mm-hmm. I think another one that a lot of people talk about is blockchain and just the highest, or cryptocurrency blockchain, that just at the highest level, there's like two underlying technology advancements in it. So one is just this decentralized ledger. So when you did transactions in the past, you have a bank, there's some big database that the bank has, and all the transactions get recorded in that bank database. And that's kind of the centralized version that you see on the left. And then the right is this decentralized model where there was a cryptography and technology invention that essentially allowed people to have a distributed ledger and make sure that no forgeries or false transactions were added to it. So I would say, so this is a very powerful technology trend which can enable a lot of decentralized type applications. And the second with blockchain is smart contracts. So the idea that, you know, we all know we've signed contracts, right? You have these contracts are written typically here in English on paper. Can you digitize those contracts and make it frictionless? And when you do that, you can do what's called trustless transactions. So in the past, there's a lot of trust required. I want to do something with Rick. We can have this agreement, but I have to have a level of trust that's kind of embedded in that. Sometimes I solve that with escrow agents or other things like that. But in this model, because the smart contracts are all kind of collectively agreed on and self-enforcing, I can have you know, I can do things with someone that I might not trust as much or have not built trust with. So there's a lot of, you know, pretty exciting examples of how that works as well. So, for example, like decentralized power, if you ever, everyone has it, say everyone had, say we were in Arizona, we all live in Arizona, and everyone puts a solar panel on their house. You could, you know, you in theory, with the quality of some of the underlying solar panels and their efficiency going up at an exponential rate as well, you can, we could build a system where we all agree to share and trade power with each other and don't necessarily need a centralized power system. But you then have to have trust with like millions of other people in this network. How do you do that? Well, these underlying technologies could allow that, that kind of thing to happen. Mm-hmm. So those are a couple. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are two big technology trends. And I think since we're talking about blockchain, you can't but notice the 80% drop in market values. So, okay, well, if you don't notice it, I don't know. That's if you didn't know about this, then that, you might be happy. You didn't have to have too much of a roller coaster ride. But, you know, pretty much asset prices on kind of, whether it's kind of, yeah, blockchain or Ethereum are down 80% over December highs. And so this is the, this is just the story. This graph is another mental model. Sorry, I seem to work with these mental models. But yeah, this one is essentially, it's called the Gartner hype cycle. And you go through this process where you have the, you know, this new innovation, this maybe technology innovation. And then everyone's really excited about it. And that is, it goes to this peak of inflated expectation. So if we take blockchain or cryptocurrency more generally, I mean, for sure, like last December, everyone was so thrilled and excited, especially the people that invested at like a dollar and now it was worth, you know, $19,000. Some very nice hedge fund returns in that period. And then all of a sudden people start to say, okay, the hype's dying down. Like, can this actually work and do the things we think it can? And you realize, okay, well, these Ethereum can only put through, 100 transactions or 50 transactions a second, while, you know, mass Visa is running at thousands of transactions a second. And so this isn't actually going to scale. And you start to realize, okay, there's, how are we going to solve these problems? Trough of disillusionment, where everyone's just like, okay, this thing doesn't work. And then you end up going on this slope of enlightenment where slowly things, you know, the thousand things you had to improve to get it to really work happen, and you're now kind of productive. So this is the Gartner hype cycle model, and definitely I think is applying a lot to kind of what we're seeing in the blockchain space as well.
So just to wrap up, and if you have any questions, again, the number is on the screen, but it's 778-628-5131. So whether for John or for other speakers, if you have questions, just text them to me. So just to wrap up, what would you see as maybe like a key ethical issue? So, you know, we live in a world where there's ongoing, rapidly developing things happening in the world of tech.
Yeah.
What would be, from a Christian standpoint, maybe like an ethical issue or something,
sure.
some way to filter out what's happening?
Yeah. I guess some technologies raise new ethical questions. Like, I think some of the new, like, CRISPR-Cas9, I don't know how much you've heard of, like, the bioengineering that's now, we're now able to do. Let me see, I think we had... Yeah, this is, I mean, we essentially now have the technology to edit the human DNA. And so this is a new ethical question that we will all face over the next, you know, 10, 20, 30 years. So there's this kind of CRISPR-Cas9 technology that has huge positive potential. I think of any genetically inheritable disease, when this technology is mature, you can kind of snip out, kind of like this example shows, snip out the offending parts and swap in something else. So some of these diseases, like, for example, a lot of people are saying, okay, Hunter's syndrome and some of these others, there's a lot of potential to just eradicate those. So that's the maybe kind of fixing kind of errors in our genetic code. But then there's the augmentation and enhancement side of things. And that raises so many interesting questions. Like, it raises questions around, like, what does it mean for us to be made in the image of God? How much do we want to play with our own DNA? You know, some people would say, well, we're just taking the local optimizations of DNA across the world, and we're just going to combine all of those into my child.
Well, and then the other thing we talk about, can you imagine, so you can actually edit your own, the DNA of various people, but what if you could increase your life expectancy to about 150?
Yeah.
So would that be a good thing? You imagine like the ethical issues of this whole notion of playing God, where you start editing your DNA, extend life expectancy, so people will start living to 150. Yeah. So what if you could actually program those types of things?
Yeah.
That's an interesting thing. And then, of course, there'll be entrepreneurs who will be marketing those services and taking advantage, profiting from it.
So we have to consider how we as Christians respond to that. Yeah. And I was at a session in Oxford in June, and it was run by a few theologians, and they had a bunch of science folks that were talking about this problem. And a lot of the folks that are actually doing this kind of work were like, okay, we need to talk about the ethical implications of this more, because in our labs we're busy doing all these experiments, but we haven't stepped back to think deeply about it. But the good or the bad news, I think, is that I don't believe we'll come to a global consensus on the ethics of this, mm-hmm. and so it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to have to figure out, you know, how do we as maybe a Christian community or individually look at that.
Yeah. Great. Well, thanks a lot for your insights. And John will be hanging around for the rest of the day. And so if you have any questions you want to pose directly, then you can track them down at the break or throughout the rest of the day.
Awesome.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.